Today on the 21st, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan on Governor Bruce Rauner, Donald Trump, and more.
Bruce Rauner is of record that he will fully support the Trump candidacy. It's documented. It's available.
Plus, the United Way of Illinois joins us to share how it's trying to fill in the massive gaps left by social service agencies crippled by the state budget situation. Also, the science behind what's in sunscreen and what you need to know to protect your skin.
It is much worse to not wear sunscreen at all than to worry about, little compounds in there that are probably not going to hurt you anyway.
Ian will talk with a graduate student who says he used to be self-conscious about having Tourette's syndrome, but now he wears his disability with pride.
I want people to know that it's okay to be yourself and we should be proud of who we are.
That's all coming up this hour. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st, this August 1st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Michael Madigan isn't just Speaker of the House in Springfield. He's also Chair of the Illinois Democratic Party. Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky sat down for an extended interview with Madigan as the Democratic National Convention wrapped up last week in Philadelphia. As part of the interview, the longtime speaker drew a strong connection between Governor Rauner and GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. Although Rauner has not endorsed Trump directly and has, in fact, distanced himself from the presidential candidate, Madigan says he sees many similarities between the two businessmen turned politicians.
Bruce Rauner is of record that he will fully support the Trump candidacy. It's documented. It's available. He's trying to backpedal by not attending the Republican convention in Cleveland. But he is of record that he fully supports Trump. And if you study the statements and the actions of both men, you'll see a great similarity in their methods, in how they castigate people, and how they're always criticizing people, never talking about their own programs. And so I think I'm fully justified in linking Trump and Rauner together in extremism. I view them as extreme. I don't think America likes extremism. I think America wants a full, healthy debate, and then they want people to come together and settle somewhere in the middle.
Madigan also discussed the many battles he's waged with Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, including one over college affordability.
We fought for a year and a half against the extreme efforts of Governor Rauner to either reduce or eliminate the MAP program in Illinois. The MAP program is a program that helps poor kids get through college. Democrats in the Illinois legislature fully support that program. We passed several bills to implement the program. Governor Rauner has worked against the funding for the program. Now, in the end, as part of a negotiated settlement, he agreed to pay for the full MAP program in the last budget year, leaving open the next budget year. So if you're a poor student today planning to attend college in Illinois starting in September, you don't know the status of the MAP program. You don't know whether there'll be state support for your college tuition or whether it won't be there. That's the product of the Rauner extremism in Illinois. It's wrong. It ought not to happen. If Bruce Rauner wants to pick on some people, he ought to find some big people to pick on, not little people that are trying to put themselves through college.
Speaker Madigan repeated his statements that he's made that Governor Rauner's budget proposals would have a negative impact on not just students, but wages and the standard of living for the state's citizens. Amanda Vinicky's entire interview with Speaker Madigan is available online. We'll tweet out that link. It will also be posted to 21stshow.org. On a related note, we've been reporting for months on the 21st about how much not having a state budget has hurt social service agencies and the most vulnerable that they serve in Illinois. Today, we wanted to talk about how that's affecting agencies that aren't reliant on state funding like the United Way. The organization is finding itself overwhelmed by need because of the state budget impasse. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with the United Way about how they're coping. But first, we wanted to talk to the Family Counseling Center in Southern Illinois. Carrie Moore is a compliance director and spokesperson for the Family Counseling Center in Vienna. According to Carrie, the lack of state funding from the Illinois Department of Human Services isn't just affecting those in dire need of their help, but the entire community of Vienna, where the Counseling Center is the third largest employer in town and is now faced with major layoffs. Carrie Moore joins us on the phone from Vienna. Carrie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie, can you explain what the Family Counseling Center does, first of all?
Yes. Our counseling center provides behavioral health services, developmental disabled services, and assisted living services. for up to 1,200 clients is what we're expecting this year. So we provide behavioral health counseling, substance abuse services. We have residential facilities. Pretty much it's a one-stop shop here in this community to provide mental health and behavioral health services.
And Carrie, I know you're joining us via your cell phone because your organization's phones have literally been shut off right now because of funding. And I know that you all have been dealing with this for the state and past budget for the year. I wonder how the past year has been for the agency, whether the stopgap funding budget that was passed a month or two ago, if that helped you all at all.
Well, you know, we are humbly grateful for the stopgap budget, but you can see that getting paid 65 cents on the dollar is just not good enough for us to be able to bring back staff, to re-implement programs. The legislators tell us to wait till January for new revenues, but in the meantime, our bills are going to continue to grow. Our infrastructure is going to continue to shrivel. Waiting on the increases is just, they're walking us into cuts we can't sustain. So we have received one payment so far as a result of the stopgap budget, which was about $17,000. But considering that, you know, what they owe amounts to roughly $610,000.
I'm sorry, the state owes you $610,000?
That's right.
And so far you've gotten $17,000 of that?
That's right. So at this point, we are still maintaining in the same way we were prior to the stopgap budget being passed. So we have not been able to, you know, bring back programs or bring back staff as a result of the budget being passed.
How many programs and staff have been cut over the past year because of this?
We laid off or reduced the hours of 36 staff in fiscal year 16. And there were also several cuts that were made as a result to just kind of keep afloat. That includes reducing benefits, holiday and personal time. We shut down a homeless youth facility in Rosa Claire, Illinois, that served homeless youth because we just literally could not keep it open without any payments from the state. We've reduced a juvenile justice program for youth, and then we've had to downsize two of our offices. So there's not one employee that we have that hasn't been impacted in some way by this budget impasse, whether they work in our behavioral health department or not.
And when you said you've had 36 people who've either been laid off or had their hours reduced, is that your entire staff? Or how many, and what percentage of staff was laid off versus how many had their hours reduced?
Well, we right now we have 132 employees. So obviously this is a little bit low for us. You know, going into the year last year, we had over 140 employees. So we have, you know, we've really suffered in terms of being able to maintain staff with the kind of cuts that we've had to make, whether it's our reductions or a complete layoff or even just the losing of benefits. These are all things that are very important to employees when they're looking at a potential, you know, employer to provide services with.
Well, and Carrie, as we're thinking about that, as you're talking about the Family Counseling Center, not just serving a population that's needed, but you're also, are you all considered the largest private, or I guess maybe the largest nonprofit employer in Vienna, or where do you all rank in terms of one of being a size of employer in the town?
Right. Well, we are, as you mentioned already, we are the third largest employer in Johnson County, which is where one of our primary offices is located. And then the other two is the prison and the school system. So you can see that it's, you know, this is all kind of part of how human service providers are really driving the economic force in this area.
Mm-hmm. How would you say it's affecting the overall community in that sense?
Well, if you're talking about lost jobs, you're talking about reduced access to services, you know, the burden, you know, falls on other community resources that are already limited, like state hospitals and things like that, especially in this rural area. We just have such a lack of goods and services in this area that when you do something like take away jobs or take away services, it really impacts the community as a whole.
Thanks for joining us. Carrie Moore is the compliance director and a spokesperson for the Family Counseling Center in Vienna. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, as Carrie is saying that, I wanted to bring the United Way into this conversation. Back in June, the United Way chair of Illinois sent a letter to the General Assembly and the governor, and that letter read, in part, 52 local United Ways that make up the United Way of Illinois continue to provide support and funding to our partners, but private philanthropy cannot possibly fill the hole left in the absence of state funding. Nor can human service providers continue to do their critical work without a line of sight to what state funding they can operate in this coming year. That letter was sent on June 30th, and we wanted to have the United Way join us now. Jack Kaplan is joining us. He's the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with the United Way, and he joins us now to provide a little bit more insight into this. Jack, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you.
That letter was sent before the stopgap budget was passed. I wonder if you could fill us in now. We've been hearing from Carrie about how much relief her agency got with the stopgap funding. Not very much. I wonder what the United Way thinks about the current situation, first of all.
Yeah, well, I thought Carrie did a really good job of describing what the impact is having in one particular local community. And the story and the picture she shared with you, I think, is very descriptive of the situation in communities across the state of Illinois. So what she's describing is similar in terms of loss to staff, cuts to programs, and most importantly, a lot of clients and vulnerable residents across our state who are losing services. In terms of the stopgap budget that did get passed at the end of the fiscal year on June 30th, as Carrie mentioned, it provides some small amount of relief. I think our partner agencies that we work with are grateful that there has been some attention paid and some resources that are going to be available to pay for the contracts, but it doesn't make them whole. As she said, it's about 65% of the amount owed. And remember, you know, what you got to remember is that these are agencies, these nonprofit agencies, that all had contracts with the state. They had promises from the state. They delivered these essential, critical services in their community. And then they've gone unpaid and waiting for payment over the course of last year. So even when they get paid some small amount on what is owed to them, it really isn't enough, as Carrie described, to maintain the services in the way that they were before.
Now, you all did a survey recently with looking at social service agencies throughout Illinois, and I imagine some of those were mostly your partner agencies, but there were others as well, saying that about half of their clients, according to who you surveyed, about 1 million people had to be turned away from services. Can you tell us a little bit more about the survey and what you found out with it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So we decided actually at the beginning of the fiscal year last July, when this first started, that we felt that one of the things that we could do to shed some light on the impact of the impasse on human services was to do a survey of agencies across the state. Little did we know, of course, when we did our first survey last July, that we would have to do it on a repeated basis over the course of the year. It really has been an unprecedented situation that we're faced with in Illinois. But over the course of those four surveys, we've had anywhere between about 450 and between 400 and 600 agencies, human service agencies across the state, respond to our survey. And most of them are United Way funded agencies, but not all of them. And importantly, they really do represent a cross section representing every community, every size of human service of social service provider, and every type of service that's being delivered in the human services field.
And when you say they're United Way funded, can you explain where the United Way gets its funding and how that works with partner agencies and who you all fund?
Sure. So United Way raises its money in the private sector. We are not government funded. All of our money that we raise through our annual campaigns in our local communities across Illinois are raised through workplaces from individual giving and from contributions that are made by various individuals, companies. And those all are the dollars that support the investments that our local United Ways across Illinois make into local agencies, local social service agencies that are on the ground and are the ones that are meeting the need in the various areas of need.
Jack, how's fundraising been for United Way over the past year? Because it's sort of an interesting point that Carrie was making. We're thinking about cuts to social service agencies and how they're affecting clients, but also, of course, they're laying people off. And we're finding increased amount of layoffs just in the nonprofit sector. So I wonder if we think about state universities and other state workers being worried about their whether they've been laid off or being worried about their paycheck and worrying about the budget impasse. Has that affected your ability to fundraise this year?
Yeah, I think it has. There's no doubt that you know a lot of the individuals that contribute to United Way are the people that you're exactly talking about. So a lot of them work for local schools, local universities, and so to the extent that they are themselves under threat or under concern about their own paychecks and their own incomes, that is going to have a ripple effect on contributions that they're able to make as well.
And also, when we're thinking about your ability to fundraise, just to be clear, you guys, as you said, you don't get any funds from the state. So what kind of response are you seeing now in terms of partner agencies and your ability to make up that funding?
Well, again, as Carrie said, we United Way and private philanthropy in general is in no position and in no way can fill the gap that is left when the state does not fund human services. We're talking, while United Way is the largest non-governmental funder, we fund across Illinois, we invest over $100 million into human services across the state. That is a very small part of the funding that goes to our social service agencies.
Jack, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you for just a minute because we're going to take a break. Can you hold on and we'll pick up this conversation in just a few minutes?
Certainly.
Okay, thanks. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. We're going to continue this conversation with Jack Kaplan of the United Way of Illinois. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the state budget situation. We know there's been stopgap funding. As we were just hearing from the Family Counseling Center in Southern Illinois in Vienna, not enough. We're now talking with the United Way of Metropolitan Chicago. Jack Kaplan is their director of public policy and advocacy. We're talking about a recent survey they've been doing. As Jack's been sharing with us, they've been surveying partner agencies and other social service agencies throughout Illinois over the past year to see how they're being affected. You know, Jack, just before the break, we were talking about funding. I just want to go back to the survey for a minute because you were saying that in your most recent survey that more than a million people in the state of Illinois have been without service due to the state budget crisis. But your data only shows responses from 429 social service agencies in Illinois. So I guess I'm wondering if these numbers even show the full severity of the situation that agencies and clients across Illinois are facing.
No, it's not even close. Just as you mentioned, I mean, our survey is really, we see it as a representative sample of the impact that this impasse has had, because those 429 agencies that responded that do get state funding, that is only a small portion of the total number of agencies across the state. For instance, we know that the Illinois Department of Human Services, which is one of the major state agencies that does fund human services, they have somewhere over 1,200 agencies that they contract with on an annual basis for services. So, and that does not represent all of the contracts with agencies. So, this is not that 1 million clients that we report in our survey is illustrative, but does not in any way capture the full impact that this impasse has had on those clients across the state of Illinois.
You also found that nearly two-thirds of agencies responded, said they've tapped into their cash reserves, they've used lines of credit. I wonder, we're in such an unprecedented situation now, what your partner agencies are saying about being tapped out of other resources.
Well, that's an increasing serious concern because, they rely on those reserves for the rainy day fund, that's the situation that they're called for. And now they have not only been exhausting their cash reserves, but they've actually been going out and borrowing against those, against their ability. And there's no assurance right now. Again, as you heard earlier, there's no guarantee right now that those agencies are going to get fully reimbursed for the services they've rendered and the payments they were expecting. And so they really are increasingly under threat in terms of their ability to keep their doors open, to sustain their operations, and meet the needs of the clients in their local community.
And Jack, as you said before the break, and we were just talking about the United Way getting its funding from private, you know, you all are funded privately, you're not funded from the state. Has the United Way, I imagine, have you had partner agencies coming saying, can you fund us more? Have you been able to do that?
Well, we certainly have had the requests. There's no question that our agencies are coming to us, and they're asking for additional funds, but they're also asking for their money earlier and sooner than they normally would. We are unable to meet all of the demand that they're having, as I mentioned earlier, about the gap between what we can provide and what is the role and the responsibility and the obligation of the state. But we are certainly letting our donors know. We are including in our campaign, letting people know, and folks in our workplace campaigns know about the impasse and the impact it's having on human services, and asking our donors to consider increasing their gifts given the situation we're faced with in Illinois. And we're hopeful this year because we're really just kind of getting into the campaign season right now with United Way largely. And we're hopeful that will resonate with folks around the state. But again, even if we have increases in our contributions and gifts from our donors, that in no way can make up the difference that we're facing with the state of Illinois.
Jack Kaplan is the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy for the United Way of Metropolitan Chicago. Jack, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It can be hard to sort out what's best when it comes to sunscreen and what it all means. What's UVA, for example, versus UVB? To make matters even more complicated, recently the Environmental Working Group issued a report with, quote, a list of worst sunscreen for kids. That was predictably followed by lots of internet chatter about toxic sunscreens. Lee Creech-Berner is a science editor for thesweethome.com. She wrote an article titled, Don't Let the Internet Scare You About Sunscreen, and she joins us on the line from Indiana. We're also joined by Dr. Ellen Jacobson, a dermatologist from Urbana. Lee, Dr. Jacobson, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Lee, what prompted you to write this piece about sunscreen for the Sweet Home? What kind of headlines were you seeing? Was it news headlines? Was it blogs? What prompted your concern?
Well, it was mostly, honestly, seeing this stuff crop up on Facebook, on Pinterest, people, you know, reposting this saying, oh, I didn't even know sunscreens were toxic, etc. And I think the thing that really pushed me over was seeing a blog post by a mom that basically was just tired of it. She's like, I'm just going to put toxic sunscreen on my kids. And, you know, it really spoke to me, you know, having kids, you really worry about things you put on them. Is it being harmful? And I just wanted to try to correct some of the misinformation that's out there, because I feel like a lot of the stuff that you see on the internet lacks context. And so I felt like I needed to put the context out there to help people understand that, no, sunscreen is actually not toxic. It's actually something that you really need to put on your kids to keep them healthy.
Dr. Jacobson, I think that probably happens with you all the time. I imagine you have patients coming in expressing concern. What's the first basic advice you provide to all of your patients about sunscreen?
Our concern, of course, is overall sun protection through the course of the life cycle. We know that 1 in 5 Americans is going to get some kind of skin cancer during their lifetime, and that protecting people is super important. And there are lots of ways to protect people. You know, you need to seek shade, you know, use those wonderful clothing that have high SPF in them. And then wearing sunscreen is a really important part of that, because you can't wear clothes everywhere on your body. You can't wear a bag over your head, although many of my patients wish that they had been able to do that when they were children, because their skin is so bad when they're older. Then living in such a way that you try to be inside from 10 to 2 as much as you can, organizing your kids so we're not out in the middle of the day. But if they are out, to get an SPF kind of clothing. And I do hear all the time about, oh, I'm not going to use that because that's dangerous for me. And when I say, well, you know, we don't really think that it really is dangerous for you at all to be using a sunblock, and we know it's dangerous for you to be not using a sunblock. And so to find a happy medium, I mix and match the physical sunblocks, which I think that Lee's going to talk about, versus the chemical sunblocks, because they all work a little bit differently. And I went and pulled out the 9 kinds of sunblock I had in my cabinet right before I...
9 different kinds. Well, and it's interesting because you say, Dr. Jacobson, you say physical sunblock. So, Lee, can you explain the difference between a physical sunblock versus a chemical sunblock?
Sure. The term physical and chemical just refer to how the sunscreen works to deflect the sun's rays away from your skin. So physical sunscreens, sometimes you'll hear them called mineral sunscreens. They actually physically bounce the sun's rays off of your skin. There you have things in them like titanium dioxide and zinc oxide. Chemical sunscreens have active ingredients that actually go through a chemical reaction when the sun hits them. And basically, once the sunscreen is either captured or reflected enough photons, which are particles of light, that it's broken down, you need to reapply it.
I wonder if we could get to the Environmental Working Group. They're a nonprofit organization. They say their goal is to protect public health and the environment. They issued this report that started a lot of these conversations. Oh, it sounds like they were happening already. What, Lee, can you talk about what criteria the Environmental Working Group used to rank sunscreen products?
Well, there's a couple of different things. They have a database called Skin Deep that they use to, you know, rank all kinds of products based on their ingredients, with the hazard of their ingredients, and whether or not companies disclose. In this particular thing, there were sunscreens for kids. They used a couple of things to rank these as worst. One was SPF. And so SPF is sun protection factor. And it's a number. It's like 30 or 50 or whatever. And they say you should not use sunscreen with an SPF that's really, really high, like basically 70 or 100. And we actually agree with these. SPF numbers aren't linear. So a sunscreen with an SPF of 30 does not have twice the protection of a sunscreen with an SPF of 15. Something with an SPF of 15 blocks, I want to say, about 93% of the sun's rays. SPF 30 blocks about 97% of the sun's rays, and SPF 50 blocks about 98% of the sun's rays. Now, nothing blocks 100%. So the problem with something with a really, really high SPF is that people think that they have more protection than they actually do. I'm saying if you have something that has SPF 70 on the bottle, keep using it. Don't throw it out. I mean, you already paid for it. You already spent your money on it. The problem is you just have to treat it like any other sunscreen. You still have to put a lot of it on, and you still have to put it on every hour. Another is spray sunscreens are bad, and we also agreed with that. When you use a spray sunscreen, one of the major problems with it is that it's hard to tell how much you put on, and one of the major problems with sunscreens is that you're not using enough. It's also you can inhale a spray sunscreen, which is probably not good for you. And it's also, I mean, you still have to rub it in, and people don't believe you have to rub it in either.
Dr. Jacobson, I wonder if you could weigh in here. Let's start with SPF. What do you recommend for people, and what do you think, as Lee's talking about the numbers for SPF, I know that can be confusing for people as well. How do you think people should approach SPF numbers?
I think that everybody should wear, I suggest, a 50. And one of the lines I hear, oh, it's in my makeup. And so people put on either a 15 or a 30 in the morning, but they never reapply their makeup during the day. So what Lee's saying about reapplication is really very important. So getting the sunblock on, getting a combination physical and chemical sunblock on, and then reapplying is what I do suggest. When we went to the Caribbean one year, and my sons had gotten some spray-on sunblock because they thought it would be so much easier. And so we gave it a try, and we started on the back, and, you know, I put on a big S, and then I rubbed it in. And the only place that didn't get sunburned was the big S that I had started with, because that was the only place where there was an adequate amount of sunblock to actually protect them.
So, Lee, this Environmental Working Group had ingredients that they said were concerning in these products. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. The compounds we're concerned about are oxybenzone and retinyl palmitate. Now, oxybenzone is specifically a sunscreen. It's one of the molecules. It's a chemical sunscreen. It will interact with the sun's rays, so they don't hit your skin. So the problem with oxybenzone is that it has been linked to skin allergies, although that's really quite rare condition. It's also, environmental working group says that it penetrates the skin, it gets into your bloodstream, and acts like estrogen in your body. So all of that is true. However, you know, when we get oxybenzone on our skin, it is absorbed, we flush it out in our pee, and it does have an estrogen effect. In rat studies, when researchers fed them really large amounts of the stuff, in humans, you'd have to apply a 4-ounce bottle of sunscreen every week for 70 years to accumulate the topical exposure equivalent to what the rats ate. And oxybenzone does not accumulate in our body, so it would be really, really, really difficult for us to get to that level that it would actually be harmful. Retinyl palmitate, they say it's linked to photocarcinogenicity, which means that when the sun hits it, it can cause cancer. Basically, their entire argument is based on one government study that used hairless mice. And the problem is that a lot of other people had serious problems with that study. Basically, it wasn't a good study. It didn't have good results. The results were confusing. And but they're basically redoing the study because the results didn't come out as conclusive as a lot of people would like. And so even so, I talked to Sonia Lunder of the Environmental Working Group who wrote these reports, and I asked her, I'm like, you're citing the study even though, you know, a lot of other scientists have said it's not a good study, and, you know, is it still worth citing? And she said, absolutely, in my opinion, yes. So the problem is they're using information that's not particularly conclusive. They're not putting the context in there that says, yes, this is a hazard, but it's not actually a risk. There's a difference. The risk is how likely it is that you're going to be hurt by something. A hazard is how dangerous something is, you know, but not based on like any kind of how likely it is to hurt you. So the context is important. So oxybenzone, retinyl palmitate are perfectly safe in sunscreen when used and as directed.
Dr. Jacobson, how often is it that we even see these ingredients in sunscreen? Are these two ingredients that you see?
We do see the oxybenzone in many broad spectrum sunscreens. But I think the important thing here is that in all the news that comes out that terrifies us about the environment and in, with the things that we're putting on our skin or taking in our body or not taking in our body, that correlation is not causation, that people who come up with these scary statistics really are not telling us that one thing leads to another, but that maybe they're somehow sort of related. And so we know for a fact that sun exposure causes skin cancer. We do not know anything factually about sunblock and skin cancer causing problems for people. And so wear your sunblock. Don't worry if it has oxybenzone in it. And go ahead and stay out of the sun. Don't put on your sunblock and think, oh, I can be in the sun for 5 hours now. Stay out of the sun when you can, because sunblock is not perfect, as Lee was saying. It's only even 97%, you're still getting, you know, too much exposure through time if you stay out too long. So get in the shade, get sun protective clothing, wear your oxybenzone mixed in with all the other things that help protect us, and don't get too much sun exposure.
That's Dr. Ellen Jacobson. She practices at Jacobson Dermatology Center in Urbana. Thanks also to Lee Creech-Berner, science editor from thesweethome.com. We'll tweet out the links to Lee's stories as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Navigating a PhD program is no walk in the park, and some might think having a neurological disorder would make it even more difficult. But Zach Wiersma says he considers that to be an asset. Although he used to be self-conscious about having Tourette's syndrome, he now wears his disability with pride. Zach is a PhD chemistry candidate at the University of Illinois, is in studio with us to talk about this. Hey, Zach, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you wrote about what it's like to be a scientist with Tourette's in the most recent edition of Science magazine, and you wrote about how you used to be self-conscious about having Tourette's, but now you wear that with pride. What's changed?
So a big distinction between having disability as a child and as an academic professional is just the way others perceive you. So I've known I had Tourette's syndrome since I was about 5 years old or so, and I don't really remember life without it. So it's been a part of my identity for a long time. But as you transition into an academic and professional setting, I think you find, and I certainly found this the case, that I was self-conscious of the way others would perceive me and the way it would distract others. Tourette syndrome, like you said, is a neurological disorder, and it's distracting to the sufferer, but it's also distracting people around me. I make wild movements that are eye-catching. I make noises that even if people aren't looking at me, they're hearing me around them. And so it's just a concern about how you might be perceived by the public and others in your life.
Right. And maybe you can describe, how would you describe Tourette's syndrome for us? Because I think that there's also part of the reason you're talking about this and writing about this is because there's so many misperceptions.
Definitely. Tourette's syndrome is actually really easy to describe. It's more or less an itch. So imagine instead of having to scratch your fingernails over your skin, you just had to do different motions. So I have itches to do various vocal and motor tics. So one sound that I make, one vocal tic, is I cluck my tongue. And so I just have the feeling like I have to do that.
And you also snap your fingers.
I snap my fingers.
Right.
Another vocal one that's good for the radio is I'll bite my teeth together. And so I do these with varying frequency, and some I do more than others. Like the biting the teeth one is only usually when I'm a little bit more stressed. But it's an itch, and so I just have these compulsions to perform.
So, but you also wrote that Tourette's for you is a really powerful tool that helps you connect and communicate with people. What did you mean when you wrote that?
Well, I think any unique perspective or any disability in general, it gives you a way to look at information, to look at others differently. And so for me, I perform a lot of motions, and so a lot of times my body language could be confusing if you're just going on body language alone. And so I think I have a tendency to focus not on body language and focus on people's actions or what they're really meaning. So I think that's one way that I can use it to hone in and gain more information about people and just in conversation.
Well, and as you're saying, a lot of this has to do with perception, and I think that we have kind of like this Hollywood or media version of what Tourette's syndrome is or what it is to have Tourette's. And I mean, do people obviously, I guess, make a lot of assumptions about you when they first meet you or if they hear that you have Tourette's syndrome?
I don't know that they make too many assumptions. I mean, some certainly do. I've been in public and I've heard whisperings of people questioning whether, you know, I have some sort of mental limitation or, you know, people asking what's wrong with me, especially children who don't often have filters. But in general, I think people can perceive it pretty well as long as you tell the story right. So you just have to let people know, you know, what's going on. If they do have any questions, I think it's important to get the information out there and open up dialogue about it.
So, but that's kind of must be an awkward thing for you, because when do you say that to somebody?
Usually you bring it up when you hear the whispering or when you see the glances, and you have to figure out what they're getting to. Because a lot of times it'd be strange if I entered the room and I just loudly announced to everyone, hey,
right,
everyone, I have Tourette's syndrome.
Right.
But it, you know, once you get to know people on a personal level and you talk about it a little bit more, then it's a really easy thing to bring up.
Well, and I wonder if that's something that must be a very tough thing to deal with, because then you wrote about this, especially you being obviously you're a PhD candidate for chemistry. You probably go to a lot of scientific conferences, and you wrote about this, how you're walking down the hall and you're trying to catch up with your lab mates. But you heard sort of that whispering because you were doing the vocalizations that you do and having some of the involuntary movements. Is it hard to experience that, or is it something that's just part of your life right now and you just are kind of used to it?
Sure. Well, it's always been a part of my life, more or less. Like I said, I've had it for a long time and it's been a part of my identity. But there is definitely a distinction going from childhood to academia, like I was addressing before. I think it's just people view it differently, especially in academia or in science careers, when there's a big culture of trying to put up a front, trying to be confident and strong no matter what. You don't show any weakness. And I think that can be a real disadvantage. So, and this is what I wrote about in the article, but just wearing that disability with pride and you know, not trying to hide it, always bringing it up, being open about it, I think is just really important.
You mentioned that kids don't have filters. And so kids kind of will say, kids probably come up to you and they're like, hey, what's up? What's wrong with you? Or what are you doing?
Yeah.
Would you prefer that people did that?
Oh, absolutely. I just think it's important to get it out there. And like I said, it is, you know, eye-catching. You can hear me even when you're not looking at me. And so you're aware that I'm around. So I'd rather have people bring it up. I mean, after I wrote the article, even some people I don't know, they came up to me afterwards and they said, you know, I always sort of wondered, but I'd never wanted to bring it up. And, you know, my question is why? Let's make that open. Let's have that conversation. This is something I live with, so it's fair to bring it up.
Well, and I think for those of us who don't know what your life is like, everyone's probably trying to be super sensitive. They don't want
sure.
it. They feel like, is it going to be more awkward if I acknowledge it? So what advice would you have for people who are on the other side of it? What would you want? What do you want people to say? Like, what's the appropriate thing to say?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people are different, especially, you know, people with disabilities, and some people are a little bit more shy, but I think it's important to bring it up, and I don't think people are going to be offended if you bring it up in the right way. Like, if someone came up to me and they're like, hey, you're doing a lot of weird things, what's wrong with you? That's maybe not the best way to bring
it up.
Yeah,
say what's wrong with you, maybe not me.
But if someone comes up to me and says, hey, I notice you make a lot of sounds and do a lot of movements, why don't you tell me about that? Then I'm more than happy to bring it up, and I don't mind talking about it. Like I said, it's fairly easy to explain, at least in my case, and so I like having that conversation.
When you were a child, was it harder for you to have those conversations? I imagine kids can be pretty mean. I don't know if this was something you felt like you were in an environment where you were surrounded by people where, as a child, you could have those kind of conversations, or as a teenager, or maybe later on?
I suppose I had more conversations as a teenager for the reason that a lot of kids have various vocal tics. You know, a lot of kids will blink their eyes a lot. They move a lot of facial muscles. And so it doesn't really get diagnosed as Tourette syndrome until later on. So as a kid, I don't have as many of those conversations. But around 12 or 13, when it's more common to get a diagnosis and really see that, you know, these tics aren't going away and there's definitely a prevalent disorder there, some sort of neurological condition, then I think it became more of a reality to bring it up and have those conversations. But because it had been part of my identity for so long, I was comfortable with it, and it was good to have a name on it to be able to tell people and be able to explain.
Now, you started noticing this behavior. Your parents started talking to you about this when you were what, like 4 or 5? When were you officially diagnosed?
I'd say I was officially diagnosed more in my early teens. That's just when they took me to the doctor. But my mom and dad sort of had an eye on it for a while, and they were very aware that I had Tourette syndrome, or at least some sort of spectrum tic disorder from an early age, about 5 or so. And I do have memories of, you know, being 7 or 8 in various sports leagues and doing tics like pulling my shirt over my shoulder compulsively and just other things like that.
So the compulsions, like, have they changed over time? Like, do you do different things now than you used to?
Yeah, they do change over time. I counted them a few weeks ago as I was thinking about writing this article, and I do about 48 different tics in some degree or another. A lot of them are motor tics and just moving different muscle groups, like flexing, but I do have 3 or 4 different vocal tics. But to answer your question, yes, they do change over time. Often I will do a motion or make a noise a few times, and then it just increases in frequency and my desire and compulsion to do it. And eventually it just becomes a part of the routine. And those can decrease or go away later on. But I never really know what's coming next and if they'll stay for a while.
I'm speaking with Zach Wersma. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Illinois. He wrote an article in Science magazine about wearing his Tourette's with pride. And Zach, you're also a new dad, and I wonder,
<That's right>.
congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much.
How much of being a new father is also, I wonder if that has an impact on you feeling like, I really want to talk about this and make sure that that as a parent, you know, as my kid gets older, that they're aware that this is something that's part of my life.
Sure. And I think it does. That's a really good question. For two different reasons, I think that's applicable. The first is that with Tourette syndrome, there's about a 50% chance I'll pass it on. And so my son could have Tourette syndrome. We probably won't know for a while whether he does or not, but that is a very real possibility. There's some sort of genetic component to it. And the second is that I found that Tourette syndrome has its own little difficulties in raising a child. Like, for example, I constantly
probably
make noise.
Really tired? Oh, yeah, well, yeah. I was also thinking, like, you're really tired.
Yeah, it is. It can be tiring. But say, you know, I'm trying to put him to sleep or, like, creep around and I'm making noise and it's not really something I can help, more or less. And so I'm sure at some point he filters it out and doesn't notice it anymore. But I'm always concerned when I go and I try and get in bed at night and I'm making noise and don't want to wake the baby.
Okay.
And then I mentioned earlier that I'll do a lot of flexing. One thing I flex is my elbow, the crevice of my elbow. And so if I'm holding him and I'm constantly moving that, I'm kind of moving his head up and down a little bit. And so that can disturb him too. So it just made me think about it in a different way, to where there are, you know, different activities in my everyday life that aren't hugely impairing, but it is something that does affect me and does affect the way that I interact with others and in my environment.
I forgot to, I should point out that your research is around developing hydrogen fuel cells.
That's right.
Right. So it's, yeah. It's nothing neurological or having to do.
No.
But I wonder what you think needs to happen in the scientific community to make it more accepting or inclusive and supportive of scientists who have disorders or disabilities.
Sure. I think it really all starts with and comes back around to being open about it, just having that dialogue and making known what's out there. You know, people suffer from all sorts of disabilities, some more impairing than others. So if you have a large physical disability and say you're in a wheelchair, then you need some sort of, you know, wheelchair access into a building. And so having that dialogue and then moving to make that change can be very enabling to someone. There's a lot more people with disabilities in universities and in academia now than ever before. And so just having that open dialogue, knowing that there are ways we can overcome disabilities and overcoming it together as an inclusive community, I think is just the right way to go.
And I should, your article was titled Wearing My Disability with Pride. And I think we've heard discussions or debates about whether to even use the term disability. Some people don't even like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, there's some discussion about diction and the way you phrase certain things. So disability implies that you can't do something, you're at some big limitation, which in some aspects may be true, but more than anything else, it's not saying it's not disabling you from anything. So you can still perform a lot of the same tasks, just in a different way. So I'm not one for thinking about the very particular phrasing of that, but I do think it's important that we just have that encouraging, inclusive community so no one feels like they can't do something. They just need to be enabled in some sense to be able to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess as we think about that, for people who, whether you use the term disability or differently abled or things like that, I think what you've said is you want people to be sort of open and honest with you. Are there any other advice that you have for how people should approach having conversations with you or other people about disabilities or different, or people who are differently abled or whatever term you want to use?
Sure. I just think it's important to keep in mind that we're all human beings. We all come from different perspectives and backgrounds and all sorts of things. So having a disability just provides one new, unique perspective that I can contribute. So just keeping that in mind and being respectful of everyone else, really, you can't go wrong.
Thanks for being with us, Zach. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zach Wiersma is a PhD candidate in chemistry at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out the link to the story that he wrote in Science Magazine if you follow 21st Show. It'll also be up at our website at www.21stshow.org. We'll be right back. That does it for us today. Tomorrow we'll be talking about nutrition and what healthy food is. If you have questions about what food is considered healthy or not, we know sometimes it changes all the time. Head to our Facebook page. We've got a post up there about what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. You can post some questions for our panel of experts. You can also always tweet to us at 21stshow.org or like us on Facebook. You'll see what we're talking about on tomorrow's show. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.